How often do you compare yourself to others? It's easy to envy friends' lives on social media when you only see the good parts. But comparison is the thief of joy. Online therapy can help you focus on what you want instead of what others have, because your best life is always better than the idea of someone else's. Stop comparing and start living with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com.
We could have cut to Rob Reiner's mom saying, I'll read what she's reading, you know, or whatever.
Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from two people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. And now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson and Aaron Dicer.
I've tried so hard to keep it within these walls, my own house. Ah, because you would go out tonight, the whole of London knows it. If I could only get inside that brain of yours and understand what makes you do these crazy, twisted things.
Gregory, are you trying to tell me I'm insane?
Hello, everybody. It's Wreckatopia episode 116. I'm Chris Atkinson, joined by Aaron Dicer.
Hi to Lejos Cinerinos. Almost forgot.
I was beginning to wonder if I was not being heard for some reason.
I said it. You didn't hear it?
The gaslighting began, I guess. Today's big recommend is Gaslight from 1944. And once again, we'd like to welcome Chet for coming out here and watching us talk about movies on a Tuesday. I'm going to start off our small recommends.
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty living space.
It's so small and light.
It's small. It's tiny. It's petite. It's wee.
And I am going to start with 1954's La Strada, or The Road. Maybe some people know it as. But La Strada, it's a Federico Fellini movie. I am seriously underversed on Fellini movies. I've seen 8.5, but I haven't seen very many other ones that he's made. So I bought a collection and I need to go through that collection at this point. So La Strada is about a woman whose sister dies and a man played by Anthony Quinn comes along and basically pays the family for her to come along on his traveling strongman show. And he goes out and basically he's basically a one trick pony. He's got this trick where he puts a chain around his chest and his chest bursts the chain and everybody oohs and ahs with delight. And her main function is basically to be sort of a funny comedic entertainer. And it seems like she's very popular with people when they go around and everything, but the man that is employing her does not exactly like her or really like appreciate her at all. And so a lot of this movie is about her, like, should she just run away from this dude? This dude's abusive. He's, you know, he's not giving her anything to do really that puts her skills to use. And so a lot of it is this sort of this adventure of her trying to figure out what her place in the world is, because she doesn't really want to go back home where she's poor, and she's poor here too, but she's kind of thinking of it as home. And it kind of like an idea of like what home is, even in the worst of conditions and everything. This movie has a devastating ending as well in store for you. I can't recommend it enough. It's very, very good.
As is my habit, when your small recommends come through, if I have time, I find a way to watch them. And I did with La Strada. I am more underversed in Fellini than you. This was my first Fellini movie. So I was very impressed by how dark it was. Like, you know, the idea of, you know, the kind of the themes and the thoughts that are going on here with I think there's a really interesting speech about like a pebble having purpose that I found really interesting. But more than anything, I thought the central actor here, I thought she was great. And I think it's Fellini's wife, right? You may have mentioned that.
It may be, yeah.
But she kind of had a like chaplain energy to her that was, I thought was really good. So yeah, I really enjoyed watching this. So mm-hmm. I'm glad you're recommending it. My first small recommend, let's go with TV first this time. I want to talk about Outer Range on Amazon Prime. So this season two just came out. They dropped the entirety of season two. And so there are now two seasons of this show. And this is a show, basically, the elevator pitch to me feels like it was like, what if a Western Family, but they didn't discover oil on their grounds, they discovered time travel. That's kind of that's kind of the idea here, because the time travel in this show is very much like a material. It's a substance. It's a, like a mineral that has these kind of psychotropic time travel effects. But it all comes from this hole on their land that appears every once in a while and then has, you know, effects if you fall into it, those kind of things. I don't want to give too much away. I will say this is a Josh Brolin kind of pet project thing. He directs a lot of the episodes. He's the star of the show. He is really, really good in it. Lewis Pullman is really, really good in it as well. Imogen Poots is pretty amazing in it. I really like this show, and it feels like it's kind of under the pop culture conversation. I don't hear a lot of people talking about it, but it's a lot of fun and very interesting, and I'm enjoying the things that it's saying, using time travel as kind of a metaphor. So, yeah.
I had completely forgotten about this. I started watching season one when it came out, and I think I saw maybe two or three episodes, and I was in that sort of like hedging, like, I don't know if I like this. I don't know if I'm going to go back to this or not. And then every time that happens, I seem to just like lose it, lose the interest in watching it. But hearing good things about it and hearing that season two, I mean, it even got a season two is heartening. So I may have to come back and revisit this, try to watch this again. So
yeah, never has time travel in Westerns done so well since Back to the Future 3.
Yes. You have to think fourth dimensionally. another small recommend. I feel like we've small and big recommended Catherine Bigelow a bunch on this show. I may be responsible for all of them, but Detroit from 2017 is a movie that I had not seen, and I had heard good things about for as long as when it came out, and then afterwards when it seemed to get kind of a following and everything. But this movie is about 1967 Detroit during the race riots of the summer of 1967, and it follows several different groups of people. It follows these cops headed by Will Poulter. It follows John Boyega, who is a security guard at a grocery store. And it follows these people, part of a group of singers, a Motown singers called the Dramatics. And it sort of follows their lives around until it all culminates where every single one of these characters is at the Algiers Hotel. And the Algiers Hotel, the reason why there's a big incident that happens here is there's this, during the race riots, there's these talk of snipers, and they've even brought the army in and everything to try to battle snipers in buildings and everything. And someone in the Algiers Hotel with a gun that doesn't even really fire bullets shoots outside towards the National Guard. And that sends police and the army running towards this hotel. And of course, if you've seen any kind of movie like this, you know the police do not act very well during all of this, as they try to find the shooter and even kill people on the way to trying to find who shot that gun. And it's very tense, and it's very well made. Catherine Bigelow, once again, she may know a thing or two about making movies, and this is very good. So I recommend it.
I echo that recommendation. I saw it when it came out, and I haven't seen it since, so I'm a bit on the details. But I remember really, really thinking that it fit together well and that it held that tension of what it was trying to do really, really well. So yeah, I recommend it as well.
Yep.
My other small recommend is a recent release, I think just last week. I want to talk about If. If stands for Imaginary Friend, also like What If? But it is John Krasinski's latest film. I think I really like Krasinski as a director. I think it's nice that he's trying to do something different than A Quiet Place, right? This is very much a down-the-line family film, good feelings, humorous situations kind of movie. It feels very Pixar. Like, it feels like a live-action Pixar, if you want. And that's going to hit me in all the right places. I love a movie that isn't afraid to wear its sweetness, its emotional moments on its sleeve, and this movie does that. So if that is something that's going to be annoying to you, then totally get it. But for me, I thought the emotional beats in this worked just as well as the comedy beats, and I think they both worked really, really well. I always dig hanging out with Ryan Reynolds. I like his shtick. It hasn't gotten old for me yet. And so I think he's a really fun part of this. I think all around, this is just a really fun, pleasant watch that made me tear up a few times. So I'm always down for that.
Yet another one of these movies that have come out this summer where they're like, this didn't make as much money as we thought it would. Failure.
That's right. Maybe we just need to lower our expectations of the modern idea of what the box office should be. Maybe.
I think so. And maybe we should lower our budgets on these movies too.
And maybe that as well.
All right. That takes us into our big recommend, which is Gaslight from 1944.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
Man, this is one of those where I wrote notes and I was like, man, is this going to be too long? Because everything matters in this movie.
Sure.
So I will start off, and if it goes too long, so be it. We will make the most of it. So our movie begins with some well-timed newspaper position as we see the movie begins in the year 1875, and the unsolved murder of singer Alice Alquist remains unsolved in the Thornton Square section of London. 29-year-old, 12-year-old Paula Alquist, played by Ingrid Bergman, is the niece of the deceased and is being sent to Italy to get away from the murder house and to study singing under Signor Guardi. Fast forward 10 years, and the now 29-year-old, 22-year-old Paula is singing a tragedy, but is way too chipper about it. Guardi notices that she's become happier over the last 2 weeks, which has made her singing terrible for the subject matter. What's making her happier? It's a man, and it could be anybody. It could even be that pianist who excused himself to leave just a second ago. Guardi suggests that she should pursue her happiness and not worry about the stupid singing. Paula runs out to meet her secret man, who turns out to be the pianist. His name is Gregory Anton, played by Charles Boyer. And they're apparently madly in love after 2 short weeks. Paula tells him she'd like to have time to herself for a week, and they agree to that. So she ships off on a train to Lake Como. On the train there, she sits next to an old lady having an orgasm, reading a book about murder. And then she spoils it for Paula. We find out the older lady, Miss Thwaites, a.k.a. Diggy Biscuits, is going back home. Wouldn't you know it? To Thornton Square. Because Paula is unable to hide that the name means something to her, Miss Thwaites gets mad, inquisitive about how she knows it. And oh, by the way, did you know a murder happened there? It would suck if anyone you knew was affected by that murder, Paula. Dear heavens. This trip to Lake Como isn't going to be by herself after all, as Gregory is already waiting for her when she gets off the train. Fast forward to the morning after the XXX throwdown, we find out that they're gonna get married. Gregory asks Paula where she would like to live, and after a few wrong fantasy guesses, Gregory says, "What about London? I don't know, maybe in a house somewhere in one of them squares I keep hearing about." Paula informs Gregory that she inherited her aunt's house in Thornton Square and that a murder happened there once. But is that the sort of thing you're talking about? Paula puts her head underneath Gregory so that when she describes the old house as a house of horror, she won't see Gregory's eyebrows practically arch out of the frame. She then throws out some ironic dialogue about how she's not afraid anymore because of him. After a brief exchange with the busybody T. Diggy outside of 9 Thornton Square, Paula gets a look inside the old murder house after 10 years, and a trip down memory lane in an old trophy case brings many happy stories, including the story of a missing glove that will somehow factor into the plot of this movie. Paula even unsheaths a painting of her aunt that looks a lot like her, and then Paula is reminded that she found her aunt's dead body right there below the painting. After relating what she knew about the murder, she doesn't think she can stay there, but decides that she needs to make her husband happy and stay after all. A decision is made to remove all these old memories from the drawing room to the attic, where there are all sorts of meaningless trunks and costumes, and who would ever want anything that's up there? And hell, we'll board it up too and fill the drawing room with new things. They uncover a piano, which makes Gregory play some music that is deeply associated with Alice, and it has sheet music, which just so happens to have a letter written by a Sergius Bauer to Alice just 2 days before her death, and this letter proves, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that Scotland Yard took a holiday during the investigation of Alice's murder. Hearing the name Sergius Bauer makes Gregory pound the piano keys in a sudden rage, which he claims is because all the memories of the house upset Paula so, and thus the whatever term that means telling someone that someone is or isn't happening despite evidence to the contrary begins. Gregory pockets the letter in a move that will certainly not come back to bite him later. We fast forward a bit through a conversation by Limp Biscuits and the house cook. We find out that the Anton still haven't had visitors after a few months. And then that Gregory has been telling people, including Paula herself, that she's ill. The cook walks in to hear a new maid being hired. Saucy 18-year-old Angela Lansbury playing Nancy. Gregory tells Nancy that she shouldn't worry Paula about anything, and that Paula is very particular about things, which immediately starts making Nancy hate Paula, and it shows that Paula is not the only person Gregory lies to in this movie. Gregory and Paula are about to walk around town for the first time since they've moved in, and he even gives her a family brooch, but it has a weak pin that makes it hard to fasten to Paula's dress, which gives Gregory the opportunity to tell her that she needs to be careful with it because she loses things all the time. She doesn't recall this happening before, but whatever. Gregory very intentionally sticks the brooch into Paula's purse as she watches. While getting some torture and execution lessons at the Tower of London, Paula notices the brooch missing and then starts feeling horrible. It's here we meet our last principal character, Brian Cameron, played by Joseph Cotten, who believes he's seen the ghost of Alice Alquist walking around. A doff and a nod between he and Paula makes Gregory suspicious of the man. And now it's time to take a look at the crown jewels, a room full of former princes, diamonds and pearls that would make the treasures in princes, diamonds and pearls jealous. Gregory seems to know everything about these jewels, even without looking at the guidebook. Back at home, we find out that Gregory has been going out every night to a room he's rented to work on his pianist skills. And I do mean penis skills. I think he's working to be a penis, not a pianist. Gregory asks Paula for the brooch so that he can get it repaired. She admits she can't find it, and now she's having to come to terms that she just might be forgetful and loses things all the time. So much so that when an actual lapse in memory happens, it goes a long way to proving it to her. When she tells Nancy to have a fire ready for Gregory when he gets back to the house, Nancy tells her that she's already told her that. This is where the gaslight in Paula's room suddenly dims, and we are told that no one could be using any competing gas anywhere else in the house. Paula starts hearing someone walking around above her room. Brian comes by the next day, where he notices from afar that Paula appears to have a minute case of agoraphobia, which makes him curious. At Scotland Yard, we find out Brian is an assistant to the head honcho there, and that the head honcho is none too pleased to find out that Brian's been looking through the long-closed Alice Alquist file. Asked why he's doing it, Brian relates a story of meeting Alice Alquist when he was 12 and how she gave him one of her gloves at a performance. The head honcho believes Brian is love-struck by Paula and that you shouldn't take cases just to meet women. But also, maybe you shouldn't take cases just because you think something weird is going on and you have no suspicion of an actual crime. That will not be this movie's philosophy going forward. However, we find out that one part of the case that was not explored was the case of the missing jewels that were never found. This was not part of the case file because a royal prince of some other country that gave Alice the jewels dropped all inquiries into it. Brian surmises correctly that Alice was murdered over them. But why would someone want jewels when they can't sell them anywhere? Who in the world, and specifically in this film, even has a desire for jewels? Brian is told there weren't even any real suspects in the murder, and I guess no real search of the house either, because as I have mentioned before, Scotland Yard must have been super busy or super incompetent. Jack the Ripper didn't even exist yet. Brian gets a police officer by the name of Williams to run the Thornton Square beat, tells him to be hush-hush about it. Paula and Gregory argue about what kinds of tasks you call maids for. This time, it's putting coal on the fire. Gregory very deliberately makes it sound like Paula very much wanted to ring Nancy up for this menial task. Gregory uses the time to flirt with Nancy some more, and insulting her further by suggesting Nancy should give Paula some tips on how to work on her complexion. Paula accuses Gregory of doing things that make Nancy hate her, and Gregory accuses Paula of imagining things. T. Swizzle and Brian show up pretending to be aunt and nephew, hoping to see Paula, but Gregory gets angry when Paula wants to see them, not wanting anyone in the house because she's so ill. Gregory does this thing that he's very good at throughout, in that he'll get super mad, but then realize how it looks and dials it down a notch to make it seem like he's got Paula's best interests at heart. In one of the most maddening deceptions in the movie, Paula says she would have liked to have seen her visitors, to which Gregory responds, "Oh, why didn't you tell me? I didn't realize how much you wanted to see them. All you had to do was tell Nancy to let them in." Furthering the maddening deception, Gregory tells Paula she wouldn't have had time to see them anyway, because they're going out to the theater tonight and she needs to get ready. Paula believes she's forgotten that Gregory told her about it, but Gregory, ever the one to add layer after layer of uncertainty to everything, claims that she didn't forget. This was a surprise he cooked up. See, not everything is you forgetting stuff. But anyway, what did you do with that painting that was clearly on the wall? Did you take it down and forget it? Oh, I don't know. Let's ask the servants if they know anything about it, and kiss a Bible if they didn't take it. After all, nobody has ever lied after swearing on a Bible. What's worse, Paula finds the painting easily in a place where it was found before, and she apparently forgot she did it. So fuck, Paula, we can't go to the theater tonight because you still clearly aren't ready to do that. Anyway, back to business as usual. Gregory is going to go out and work on piano stuff while Paula stays home. Paula tells Gregory that she is frightened of the house, that people are walking around on top of the house, and is worried about imagining things. Another event, a party/concert, comes up that Paula wants to go to, hosted by a Lady Dalroy, but that Gregory is already canceled. Luckily, he wrote a letter that Lady Dalroy just happens to show to Brian, who pockets it. You never know when you'll need an old RSVP. She tells him that she wants to go and that she must go. Gregory does the whole "I didn't know this meant so much to you" bit, and they decide to go. Everything is an opportunity for Gregory, though, as he uses this event to force Paula into a mental breakdown in public. This time, he accuses her of taking his watch, which is somehow in Paula's purse. Finally, Paula asks Gregory if he thinks she's insane. She suggests that this has been going on since the brooch, but even goes back further to when she found the letter. Gregory now dials up the biggest lie of the movie, in which she says on the day that she found the letter, she didn't have anything in her hands at all. And now he drops the bomb that he's been doing some research on Paula's mother, who he says was committed to a mental health institution and died there. As if that's not enough, Gregory tells Paula that the reason she must have wanted to go to the concert was to meet Brian, and this might be the first time in the movie where Gregory's own paranoia leads to incidental gaslighting, which of course Gregory turns into actual gaslighting by the end of the scene. During the foggiest night in London's history, Gregory walks to his supposed workspace, being followed by Williams, the cop. Gregory somehow disappears in the middle of all this, leading Brian to ask where he could possibly go in this immediate area. There's an abandoned house, but why would he go there? And is he using a different entrance into his own house? Why would he do that? Back at the house, Paula is experiencing the same stuff as usual. Footsteps above her head, gaslight dimming where she stands. Paula screams for Elizabeth and asks about the gas, which she has no answer for, and asks if she can hear the footsteps, which she can't because she's hard of hearing. Williams tells Brian that in his conversation with Nancy, she seems to think Paula is going to be going away for a while, and that Gregory still wants Nancy to take care of him while she's away. Brian comes up with a plan to see Paula while Gregory is away at night. Despite Elizabeth's protests, Brian pushes his way into the house, and despite Paula's protests, he pushes his way upstairs, buying her trust with her aunt's glove that she gave him years ago. Thank God he was in love with her aunt so many years ago. Brian notices the gaslight dim, which heartens Paula to the fullest, and she tells him that the gas goes down shortly after Gregory leaves, and she hears footsteps, and then the gaslight goes back up, and he comes back shortly after. When Brian gets a closer look at Paula's room, he hears the footsteps, and when Paula asks who that could be, he tells her, Mrs. Anton, you know, don't you? And after some denial comes the right answer. She gives the right answer on her own. Brian tells Paula that Gregory has been going through the abandoned building to the roof and across the rooftops back to the attic. And it's here you realize, holy shit, everything in the fucking world fell in place into place for Gregory's plan, didn't it? He makes his makes the niece fall in love with him and marry him. They move into the old house. His gaslighting worked to perfection. And he's got an abandoned house where he can just go up to the roof and re-enter his own house undetected. It's pretty clear this attic has a lot of Alice's old stuff in it. And Gregory has been looking for the prize jewels up there all along. And it somehow has taken 3 months for him to look through this shit. Luckily for Brian's suspicions, Gregory finds the jewels on the very night he's come out to snoop. Brian, never to be denied doing shady shit to prove himself right, goes and unlocks Gregory's desk, where he notices a missing gun. Paula finds the letter that Gregory says she imagined. What luck! When Paula mentions Sergius Bauer, Brian says, why, that's the pianist that worked with your aunt. And when he compares the letter to the RSVP that Gregory gave Lady Dalroy, the handwriting is a total match. Dun dun dun, Sergius Bauer is Gregory Anton, and he killed your aunt for some famous jewels. After strangling Alice, he got scared away by the 12-year-old Paula. While Brian tries to officially convince Paula of everything that's going on, the gaslight goes back up, indicating that Gregory is done. But as he's about to leave the attic, he notices something gleaming down below and notices the jewels have been sewn into some clothing that Alice wore. Gregory observes the jewels and mentally says, "My precious." Anyway, shit, they were on the same dress that she wore in the painting. Fuck. Gregory says fuck it with appearances now and uses the boarded up entrance to enter the house instead of going through all the other nonsense. Seems as if the boarding up was just another deception, because he's got a key to what looks like a door disguised as a board up job. Gregory notices his desk has been tampered with. He accuses Paula, who in turn accuses a pronoun of doing it. Who's the pronoun? Well, there is a man, a certain man. And for the poor, you can be sure that he'll do all he can. Anyway, Elizabeth takes over the gaslighting and says she didn't see a man or let anyone in. Poor Paula. Even when something is in the works that is good for her, it requires continued lying. You see how it is, Elizabeth. And she says, yes, sir, I see just how it is. In such a way that Gregory looks back at her like, huh? The fuck does that mean? After Paula sings the first few bars of the Everly Brothers, All I Do Is Dream, we see Gregory couldn't be more delighted. Now Paula's coming up with stuff he didn't even make up himself. Except then there's sudden Joseph Cotton in the doorway, ready to let Paula off the hook. After Paula goes back to her room, Brian tells Gregory he knows everything, leading to Gregory pulling out his gun, but getting stopped by Brian, who ties him up. Elizabeth yells out for Williams to run in and help, and this brings Nancy and Tea and Biscuits into the house as well. Paula gets a chance to talk to Gregory in the attic while he's tied up. He asks her to get a knife out of a drawer to cut him free, and then she tells him she doesn't see a knife, just as she pulls the knife out of the drawer, telling him he must dream putting a knife there. She taunts her husband with all the lies he's told her. Hell, she even conveniently finds the missing brooch. Well, sometimes you stick a letter in your desk. Sometimes you stick a brooch in the attic. Who can keep up with these things? She claims she's mad and that her mother was mad. And Gregory finally tells her that wasn't true at all. And then she says, this is probably the thing that won her the Oscar. If I were not mad, I could have helped you. Whatever you had done, I could have pitied and protected you. But because I am mad, I hate you. Because I am mad, I have betrayed you. And because I am mad, I am rejoicing in my heart without a shred of pity, without a shred of regret, watching you go with glory in my heart. Brian takes Gregory away, but perhaps he realizes in the end that what he really should have been pursuing the whole time was a happy life with his wife, whose aunt he murdered. Brian tells Paula he's interested in visiting her a lot, which Miss Thwaites is privy to hear at the end. Well, she says for the third time in the movie, and it ends. And Aaron Dicer, what did you think about this movie?
I really, really liked it. This is it's wild to me that
the term gaslighting feels so modern. You know, when it was whatever the play came out in the 30s and then, you know, two movies in 1940 and 1944, which I'll talk about a little bit more because I did manage to watch the 1940 version as well. It's so clearly a psychological type of manipulation that needs a name, right? And so, like, there's this very direct thing that he's doing with convincing her that she's going crazy that is this manipulative thing that humans do to each other, and to be honest, usually men to women, you know, to convince them that they're the problem, not, you know, us. And I just, I was kind of in awe of that, if nothing else, just how well it kind of portrays that idea of gaslighting. I think Joseph Cotten is great. Everything I see him in, I love him in. I think the first thing I ever saw him in was when I was going through all Hitchcock stuff when I was much younger, in Shadow of a Doubt. He's Uncle Charlie in Shadow of a Doubt, which would make a crazy good double feature, by the way, with Gaslight. It's not my choice, but has a lot of the similar thing. It's technically not gaslighting what he's doing. He's just hiding, and you know, his Charlie figures him out. But he's so good, and just to see him kind of in a simpler, like, I'm going to figure this out kind of role, I really liked. You mentioned how crazy excited that woman is about reading murder stories, and you're absolutely right. Like, we could have cut to Rob Reiner's mom saying, I'll read what she's reading, you know, or whatever, after that scene. I actually had that noted down. Lansbury is a revelation at 18 years old, 17, I guess, when they started filming. There was a story I read in the trivia that she has a smoking scene and they wouldn't let her do the smoking until she was actually 18. So they actually had to hold off filming that scene until she turned 18. So I found that interesting. But she's absolutely incredible in this. The final scene is so good. I think, like, if I were to boil down, like, why this movie was as successful as it was and why the story works as well as it does, it is that turn that's made kind of, it's made twice, actually, towards the end. Both the Joseph Cotten character makes it and she makes it, where his words, his lies get turned back on him. Like, Cotten says something like, you know, well, I'm a ghost, I'm an apparition, so, you know, my motives don't even matter, or whatever he says, you know. And then her thing with the knife is just such a classic line, where she's like, are you suggesting that there's a knife that I'm holding in my hand? I don't see, maybe there's not a knife. I don't see a knife. It's just,
right.
It's such good stuff. There was a back-to-back with Gregory and Brian that I made note of and I wanted to mention, because I love it when a movie will turn a line like this. But Gregory says, I knew from the first moment I saw you that you were dangerous to me. And Brian responds, I knew from the first moment I saw you that you were dangerous to her. And it's this real great look at perspective, right? Like, you know, the selfish perspective of Gregory versus the chivalrous perspective of Brian. So, I found that really interesting as well. I'll let you talk for a little bit more, and then maybe I can mention some of the 1940 stuff. But is there anything else that you kind of wanted to go into with the movie?
I mean, really, the only thing I want to say here is that the piling on of the deception is expertly done, and you know, it's done. And, you know, you talked about it at the big beginning. You it's so unique in a way that it has to have a name. And he does so many different kinds of deception in this thing, where it's just like, oh, this is something you're forgetting, or, you know, or especially the thing where he's like coming. When he says, oh, I was just going to surprise you about going to the theater tonight. And then that just turns out to be its own weird deception, because it still makes her feel like she's forgetting things, even when he's telling the truth to her and everything. And you can see it in he's not happy at first with that they're going to that concert or whatever, but you can see him as he's getting prepared up in his room He's like you can barely, you can pretty much see the light bulb come up above his head. He's like, oh, I can know what I can do with this. Mm-hmm. This will be exactly. perfect, you know? And so I also think it's kind of, it's very creepy, of course, the way he and Nancy interact throughout this entire movie. Now, it's funny, you mentioned the 1940 version mm-hmm. of this to me while we were preparing for this and everything. Now, I did actually end up, because it's on the Blu-ray, the 1940 version of Gaslight really makes that more explicit because it's, because they are actually like kissing and going out and
it's that type it made of me it made me think I missed something in the 44 version, like when I watched mm-hmm. the, because I watched them backwards, I watched the 44 first, you know, just because I needed to watch that for the prep, and the 40 was just kind of a bonus mm-hmm. and then the like the affair stuff with the maid was so clear in the 40 version that I was like, wait, did I miss that in the 44 version? It's kind of hinted at, there's a little bit of flirty, but it's explicit in the 40 version for sure. And when I say explicit, I don't mean sexually explicit.
No.
I mean, it's explicitly said. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, in the 44 version, there's a lot of things that you can take certain ways in this. Like, you don't, like, are they having an affair secretly mm-hmm. in this
right,
movie?
Yeah.
Like, cause there's a point where Nancy is getting something prepared for Paula, and she says, well, will the mister be going with you as well? Almost like in this idea of like, hopefully you get out of the house so that we can like canoodle finally mm-hmm. or whatever. Yeah. I don't know. But there's a lot of like time that has passed that we're not entirely sure of in this movie. But that was a thing that was sort of the undercurrent of this whole thing. They kind of make her, Nancy, out to be like, oh boy, does she like to go around with men, you know? It's like but I don't know if they really are judging her all that much, even for a 1940s movie.
I don't think so,
that part where he says men might take advantage of you, and he's like, I'm not worried about that even when I want to, or where
he's yeah like, yeah she's like, I can take care of myself if I want to.
So anyway, the thing that this 44 version has way over on the 1940 version is that the deceptions that these piling up are just like, you know, are otherworldly. They're on mm-hmm. another level. And the 40 version is very basic stuff. You know, it's the same kind of thing going on, but it's not nearly to the level of yeah. what's going on in the 44.
It also avoids any of the setup. The 40 version just starts like with them, I'm trying to remember what the first scene is, but like there's none of that like falling in love and waiting for, like it starts with them married and the deception is art. Like it cuts out the first 20 minutes of the movie basically. In the 40 version. My favorite story about the 40 version has to be that when they made the 44 version, MGM tried to burn all the existing copies of the 40 version to make the world think it didn't exist. The movie Gaslight tried to gaslight the world into believing there was only one version. In fact, the only reason versions of the 1940 movie exist is because they were labeled with the shooting title of the movie and not the title that mm-hmm. it ended up with. That was some of the most fun trivia I saw. It was just like they just were like, no, we don't want people to know there was another one. We don't want people comparing them, because they're the same story. Like, you know, all the beats are there in the 40 version. I thought that was really funny.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Okay. Did you have anything else to add?
I think that's pretty much it. I think I covered everything I wanted to. I'm now starting to wonder if maybe the maid stuff wasn't as clear because Lansbury was so young that maybe mm-hmm. they just didn't want to go there. But I don't know.
Well, there's enough of knowing looks from Charles Boyer in this movie after she says certain things that mm-hmm. it's clear that there's a pursuit going on in some way, especially when there's the whole thought that after Paula has left to the mental institution that they're going to put her in or whatever, that she's going to stay behind and take care of him and everything. And so there's a lot of like implied stuff in it, but anyway, What is your, let's get to the super secret double feature on this
one. I love a great deal as much as the next guy, but I'm not going to crawl through a bed of hot coals just to save a few bucks. It has to be easy. No hoops, no BS. So when Mint Mobile said it was easy to get wireless for $15 a month with the purchase of a 3-month plan, I called them on it. Turns out, it's really that easy to get wireless for $15 a month. The longest part of the process was the time I spent on hold waiting to break up with my old provider. To get started, just go to mintmobile.com/recotopia. There you'll see that right now, all 3-month plans are only $15 a month, including the unlimited plan. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. You can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all of your existing contacts. Find out how easy it is to switch to Mint Mobile and get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month premium wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/recotopia. That's mintmobile.com/recotopia. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/recotopia. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 GB on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
I went round and round and up and down. There's so many Hitchcock movies that could be a great double feature to this. He uses these kind of themes of people not being who they say they are so many different times. Suspicion, Rebecca, like so many of those movies would be a great double feature with this. But I wanted to avoid those. To be honest, the best double feature is probably Diabolique that you mentioned last week. Like it's so perfect for this. Mm-hmm. I wanted something that felt like a different kind of gaslighting that we hadn't seen that kind of had some of the same beats. So I went with the Truman Show for my double feature.
That's a good one.
And yeah, it is very much gaslighting. They are gaslighting Truman into being on this reality show, and there's a lot of moving pieces to it. But you know, eventually he has to find his way out. So I find kind of the God character that is being played to be similar to, you know, what Gregory is doing in the original one as well. We had enough beats that seemed the same to me to go with the Truman Show. I thought that would be fun.
Yeah. All right. Awesome. Okay. So what is next week's homework going to be, Aaron?
Next week, since I will be in Vegas when we record, if all goes well next week, let's talk about Ocean's 11 for the big recommend.
Okay.
Excited to take a look back at this one, and just always it's a great, great movie to rewatch. Just love watching Ocean's 11, so I'm excited to go over it again.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Awesome. I love Ocean's 11. I've seen it plenty of times, so it'll be fun to revisit it in this format. Mm-hmm. All right. Looks like we have some time for some questions.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I am listening.
Any memorable movie attending moments you haven't told the stories about or haven't told in a long time?
Movie attending moments. I was just thinking the other day about my Dumbo 2019 version movie experience, movie attending moments.
Okay.
So there were several things that this was at an IMAX screen, and this about partway through the, I don't know how to explain it, but you know how like on like a Windows operating system or an Apple operating system, you have the programs down at the bottom or whatever. Mm-hmm. Those showed up at the bottom of the screen. So whatever computer system they were using, like some of the interface was showing on the screen. It wasn't, you know, I don't even know how that happens, but so they tried to reset things, and there was this big, waiting time while they were resetting. Well, the lights were still on, and I was in the back row. So I started doing shadow puppets during this,
break in just, you know, doing like a rabbit or whatever, because I could reach, you know, I'm tall and the light was right there. And so I would do that and just did a little play for all the kids to keep them occupied while we were waiting for Dumbo to come back. When Dumbo came back, it came back with the pre-roll ads rolling over top of it. So it was like Dumbo visuals and then the mix of the Dumbo sound and the pre-roll sound. It was a terrible, terrible projection job by the IMAX crew that day, but I tried to make it as fun as possible.
Oh my god. Okay. All right, so having worked in movie theaters from 1993 to 2013, I have quite a few of these, but the funnest one, and I don't know if this is the spirit of the question, because it's movie attending, like that sounds like to me like I bought a ticket and went in, but the as far as just experience in a theater, there was an ice storm in Middle Tennessee. It's around 1995, 1996, December, January. And that was where I was at my first ever movie theater. And I was basically out when that happened. And so I didn't really want to go home with all the ice on the roads. And I don't remember how this happened, but I eventually called some friends to come over to the theater. And I don't remember if they were already there or if they came out after, you know, like maybe we knew it was happening and wanted to get some people in. I don't know how this all occurred, but I brought a bunch of friends to come out. And while this ice storm kept us in, we basically had this big movie marathon that night. So the movies that had come out during this time were stuff like the original Toy Story, which is behind my head right now. Sabrina, Grumpier Old Men, Cutthroat Island. There were probably more, and possibly Jumanji, the original Robin Williams Jumanji, was in that group. But it was one of those where we started off with, I think, like Toy Story or something like that, and then worked our way to a point where it was like, I want to watch this. No, I want to watch this. I was like, we can have both theaters running those movies. Yeah. So that was a very memorable night of working at a theater that very few people in that company really cared about. So like, there wasn't any danger of anybody coming by and being like, what's going on here? You're fired.
Yeah.
So that's something
that's
fun. That I remember.
Absolutely.
Oh yeah. Let's see. What is the best ballpark, stadium, arena food you have ever had?
This is tough for me because that's not something I'm seeking out, so I just don't really remember. I'm just like, I want a hot dog, I'll have a hot dog, and it's just a hot dog. And I also don't like a lot of foods with a lot of stuff on them, so I just get stuff plain. But I do remember there was the ice cream cup at the old baseball games with the wooden spoon. I just, like, nostalgia wise, there's nothing for me that beat that. Just a little bit of ice cream or you know, whatever it is, net frozen yogurt or whatever it might be now. And I just thought that was a ton of fun. So just lots of memories at Tiger Stadium growing up with, you know, those little ice cream cups.
That's a place I wish I could have visited, is Tiger Stadium, because it was a very unique place to watch games, and I never had a chance to go see it. When we answered all these questions, Jeremy had put his own answers, and so I didn't think I would be able to say the one that he wrote, because we both had the same experience. But now that Jeremy's not here, fuck him. I'm gonna go ahead and tell you what I would have said too. He mentioned the Parmesan fries at the Giants, San Francisco Giants Stadium, and those are very, very good and highly memorable. And you know, I typically love I don't get hot dogs like these when I'm just getting hot dogs or whatever, but at a ballpark, you get the mustard and relish and all that other stuff. It's so good, man. I don't know what it is about it, but hot dogs in general, I did enjoy the Dodger dog when I was at Dodger Stadium and all that. So I would say those would be good.
I remember I worked concessions at Michigan Stadium, University of Michigan, at the Big House. And we did it with our youth group or whatever. Like, they would have, you know, organizations or whatever come run the some of the concessions. So I sold hot dogs and brats. And the thing that I think made them so different is they were put in the bun, pre-cooked, put in the bun, and then they're in tin foil, and then they're in a steamer. So that steamer, like, not only keeps them hot, but it, like, the moisture is better on those dogs. I think it was one of those things where I was like, oh, this is why they taste different than just when I make them at home. Cause not only is the dog, you know, cooked, but the bun is also moister in the stadium dogs a lot of the time. So which I like a moist bread, you know, a bread that's just kind of it's not dried out. So
as long as it's not soggy, a moist bread exactly. Can actually be very good. Yeah.
Not wet bread. That's a bread too far, but
right, but yeah. Exactly. Going back to the chat on the previous question about movie experiences. I am sorry. I think it's Snow One. Says when I was like 10 or 11, me, my cousin, and brother all went to see The Rock, but it's rated R, and none of us are over 16. They sold us the tickets, then came back in to tell us we made a mistake. You three need to leave. Ethan says I saw Avengers Endgame in theaters with a friend who was out of his mind high and proceeded to throw up 30 minutes into the movie. It smelled so bad that I went into a different theater. By the way, speaking of that, Blair Witch Project will always be the vomit movie for me, because not that I did it, but working at Hollywood 27 when that movie came out, there were so many people who had thrown up in the theater or could not get to the bathroom in time, all that. And our auditorium 16 and 17 smelt like the stuff that you use to cover up the vomit 4 months afterwards. So it sucked. Let's see. James says, I got to see Del Toro's Pinocchio in a theater, and an animator on the final shot was seated in the row in front of me on the East Coast, no less. Which reminds me, one of the other movie experiences I had was the movie Sunshine, which was at the Sunshine Theater in New York, which no longer exists, I don't think.
That's fun.
Danny Boyle was in the audience. He went out and did a Q&A, like three questions and answers afterwards. So that was really cool. As far as the venue food, there's any ice cream over those mini helmets just hits different at the game.
Yep, that's what I'm talking about.
Yep. Brat at a Brewer game wasn't bad. I bet brats in Milwaukee are very, very good. Yeah. And so, all right. It looks like we have maybe time for one more question.
Right on.
What movie character do you think you most identify with, whether it's because of who you really are or due to your interests or aspirations?
I think Norville Barnes from Hudsucker Proxy. I identify a lot with that naivete, that, you know, that innocence, that optimism. Like, there's something about, like, you know, for kids, and everybody looks at me like I'm, you know, an idiot, but there's something there. There's something simple there that, you know, might be fun. So yeah, I think I have a Norville Barnes, streak to me, that comes out quite a bit. So yeah.
I can totally see that, by the way, can totally see that. Mine would be, Albert Brooks in Broadcast News.
Yes.
The thing about Albert Brooks in Broadcast News is, you know, he's very on top of everything, but then of course you put him in front of a camera and he starts, you know, sweating and not being able to do the job exactly the way he has it in his head. And it's a disaster and everything. And I'm not saying this right here that I'm doing right now is a disaster. I don't have the same issues he's having with that, but talking about something that you're really like, you've dedicated your life to, and you come to this one moment and it's a huge disaster. And the other thing is his relationship with Holly Hunter in that movie is a lot like stuff that I've had with women in the past. Where it's like we are the best of friends, we have the best relationship. Sure, go after William Hurt instead. You know, that type of thing.
And come talk to me about it. You know, that's what I want. I want to hear all about you dating other people.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Please tell me about that. And he has one of the most devastating lines of dialogue by the end, towards the end of it, where he says that I can't remember it right now, but I just remember it being just like one of the most hurtful things you can say to a person at the end of broadcast news. That's going to have to be a big recommend at one point.
Yeah, definitely.
And now here I am like, was it a big recommend while I was gone? Anyway, that's going to do it for this episode. Thank you guys in chat so much for coming out and being part of the fun today. Next week's movie is Ocean's 11. Yes, it is the George Clooney version, the 2001, not the Frank Sinatra version. Although that one's good too. It's not. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's good as this one though. The Soderbergh Ocean's 11.
Yeah.
So this is going to be a lot of fun to dissect next week. But anyway, that's going to do it for this episode. We'll see you next time. See ya.
Bye, guys.
Bye. Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
Ian has been using my camera.
That dirty Brit. What's new in my world?
Yes.
Not terribly much new. I was wondering if you had seen the movie Pool Man.
Not that I remember. When's it from?
It's come out this year. It's in theaters. It was directed by Chris Pine, and it stars Chris Pine. It also has Danny DeVito, Annette Bening.
Interesting. I don't think I've even heard of it.
Okay, so it's got horrible reviews. It's probably, I think it was a 4.5 on the IMDb when I looked at it.
Yes. Los Angeles has a new hero. Darren Barenman, an unwavering optimist and native Angeleno, spends his days looking after the pool of a Tahitian tiki apartment block and fighting to make his hometown a better place to live.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm not going to go right out and say this movie is good. I actually very strongly considered it making a small recommend.
Ooh.
This week, but because it fits in the area of Rekha Warn back in the mm-hmm. old days,
Rekha Warn.
I was just like, I'm going to save that maybe for an outtake fodder or something like
right,
that.
Right. Yeah.
It's a really goofy, like Big Lebowski look at Chinatown, essentially.
Oh,
like it's got a lot of the same little elements. Of course, it's got its own little twists and quirks and things like that. And your tolerance of the movie may be how much you tolerate Chris Pine. I think he's just so silly. He's silly enough in this movie and likable enough in this movie that it's worth watching. There are a lot of moments where you're sitting there going, "What am I watching? What is going on? Why am I? What in the world is this?" But I'm kind of interested to see what other people think of this movie. Oh. I had been told before I saw it that it was the worst movie I've seen in forever or whatever like that.
The ratings on Letterboxd are very low. I just added it to my watch list just based on the Rekha Warniness alone.
Yeah. I can't come right out and say, man, what a resounding home run this is. It's just, it's one of those you got to see it to believe it kind of movies. Amsterdam. It kind of has that kind of weird, loose feel to it.
Hmm.
Although I would maybe prefer Poolman to Amsterdam.
That's interesting. Yeah, I'm looking, just scrolling the first page of Letterboxd or whatever, and somebody saw it, I guess, at TIFF last year, which is maybe where it premiered, maybe at TIFF last year. And the entire review is, we were supposed to watch this on 35 millimeter and the projector broke. After seeing the movie, I wish the digital projector broke too.
I can imagine if you are prepped on this movie and like, this is Chris Pine's directorial debut. You like Chris Pine, don't you? He's in the movie too. And then you are delivered this. You're going to be like, yeah, what a piece of shit. What a terrible movie this is. But like, I don't know, man. And again, a lot of times it's all about your environment and when you watch the movie, what mood you're in when you watch the movie. Yeah. I don't know. It was kind of an experience.
Yeah. I kind of felt the same way, or maybe not quite as high on it, but maybe in the Rekha Warren category about the movie last year that Charlie Day did. That he directed called Fool's Paradise. I don't know if you've seen this one, but it's basically a tribute to silent film in many ways. Charlie Day is like a, you know, I think I brought it up when we were doing, what's the movie where the guy, where Peter Sellers bumbles his way into everything that we did for Recommend? I can't even remember.
Oh, the name Being There?
Being There. I think I brought this up, Being There, because it's that same kind of character that just kind of bumbles their way into everything. And it has terrible reviews. Everybody hated it. And I watched it, and I'm like, yeah, I can kind of find some things to like in this. This is kind of fun. I smiled a few times. It kind of feels that way to me. But it's by no means a good movie. But I watched and I went, I kind of wish other people would watch this just because it's interesting, you know, like,
yeah,
it's different.
Exactly. And I would take Pool Man over half the big budget blockbusters that come out.
Yeah.
And we're there's a lot of room for these movies, but not room for this.
You've got those special variable frame rate eyes that just adjust everything automatically.
I guess. I don't know. I watched the full thing
What if I had just messaged everybody in the Sins team today and said, we're doing Gaslight, so I'd like to gaslight Chris on a few things today.
Oh.
And just had them do like, you know, first we'll start off he didn't see that. And then, you know, I'll turn my sound down and say, no, that's just you, Chris.
Oh, my God. Oh, jeez. What a nightmare. Hey, it kind of reminds me of that. I hate bringing it up because it's so embarrassing, but that whole thing with Chekhov's gun.
Oh,
Where because I related Jeremy to Star Trek so much, I didn't even pay attention to the term Chekhov's gun at all. And there was a whole argument about the spelling of Chekhov, and I was like, this is his name right here in the movie. And everybody who's sane was like, what do you mean in the movie? It's Chekhov's gun, not Anton Chekhov. what's his name?
I don't even know. I just call him Chekhov, the guy from Star Trek.
Because Anton Chekhov is, I think, what his name, what's, yeah. Is the, what Chekhov's gun is named after. Let's see. Where's Ian when you need him? Never, anywhere.
I like, while you're looking that up, one of the things I like about seeing movie actors do Broadway is they are such different skill sets in many ways because it's live and in front of you. And when you watch a movie, who knows how many takes they did? Who knows why the director chose the take that they chose? In Broadway, like live stage acting is such an actor's place to be because the actor is making the choices. They are making the performance choices. And they are doing it in a way that, you know, can't be fixed in post. So it becomes very interesting to see, you know, Hugh Jackman has that skill set. Like, you know, he knows how to own a room live and to perform like that. The other one I saw was Jeff Daniels in the Sorkin version of To Kill a Mockingbird. And he had the same thing. He just owned the room and pulled it off so well. So it's interesting to see movie stars do that.
Sutton Foster was the other.
Yeah, Sutton Foster. She's so good.
And she's so awesome. Of course, you know, people who really know their Broadway are like, how the fuck do you not remember Sutton Foster?
Right.